This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. It's always nice when you take some time to join us on your Sunday morning. Today, a show that certainly needs discussion, doesn't always get it because it makes people quite uncomfortable. But that's what Sunday mornings are for sometimes. We will be talking about sexual assault with my friends from the Sexual Assault Resource Agency, SARA, as we'll continue to talk about it through the hour. Let's see, we have our guests. We'll start with Becky Waybright. Becky, the director, executive director, what's the proper title for you at SARA?
I'm the executive director there.
Executive director, thank you for coming in today. Thank you for helping me put this show together.
Thanks for the opportunity. We appreciate it.
All the way tucked away in the corner, please behave yourself. You can't get out quite so quickly. Amanda Huskin, one of the volunteers.
Yeah, I've been a volunteer with SARA for about 3 years now.
3 years. Well, congratulations. What made you choose to do that?
I was volunteering with the crisis hotline at UVA when I was a college student, and I was getting close to graduation, so I wanted to keep doing that in the community, and SARA gave me an opportunity to do that.
Well, I'm happy that you did that. I'm sure they're even happier that you do that for them. And over here by the door, a little husky voice today.
Yes.
Mary McGregor, someone working to get your Master's of Social Work, correct?
Yes, I'm
so
at the
interning.
VCU. I've been interning with SARA since September, and I've been working within kind of sexual assault for 7 years now. So
why, you know, what makes you, as you choose an internship, we'll get into sort of the more specific purposes of what your internship, what your goals will be with that, but why SARA? Because you're at VCU, so you've got to come to Charlottesville. I'm sure that there are sexual assault hotlines in the Richmond area, are there not?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I live in Charlottesville, and I commute to Richmond.
All right. So again, Sexual Assault Resource Agency, SARA, our conversation for the hour today, Becky Waybright, Mary McGregor, Amanda Huskin. Again, thank the three of you for being here. Becky, you're a new executive director there.
Correct. I've been there since October.
Do you have a specific purpose as to why you chose this to be your next career in life?
I've worked in the field before. I worked with a joint sexual assault and domestic violence program in Richmond many years ago, and then from there I went to the State Coalition of Rape Crisis Centers. I did a couple other different things in the area. I worked at the Charlottesville Free Clinic for a while. I worked with Community Children's Dental Center, and most recently with the Housing Authority. And I was really interested in coming back to the nonprofit field, and one of the SARA board members told me when this opening came up and encouraged me to apply, and then from there, things fell into place.
All right. I want to jump right into the cultural aspect of sexual assault. We'll talk about the growth or the change of, to me, there are, Sexual Assault Resource Agency has been around since 1979. So that tells me that there was a change at that time in our culture, which said, oh, you know what? We need that. We might not have needed it before, or we did without it before, but now we need it. And here we are 33 years later. We're talking about funding. There's a big issue in our federal government that we'll get into a little later in the hour. There's a greater discussion about men and how that is a larger percentage than at least has been known about, whether or not it was believed or actually was happening. There's a bilingual. I saw on the website that there's now a bilingual representative at Sexual Assault Resource Agency. So tell me about how the cultural aspect of sexual assault has changed in the last couple decades.
I think a lot of what's changed, what hasn't changed is that sexual assault still happens. I think some of the things that have changed is that people, in some situations, people can come forward more easily. There are more resources around. People do talk about it more. I think another big piece that has changed, I think in some of the early years, there was a lot of looking at men and potentially looking at all men as potential perpetrators. And I think one of the big changes that has happened is realizing that when you've got a group of men, yes, there is a possibility that there is a perpetrator in that group, but the reality is the vast majority are not going to be. And sort of how do you kind of work at that? When we look at our prevention program, we talk a lot about bystander intervention. So we talk a lot about how do we look at potentially having men change other men's behavior versus kind of a bigger piece of that happening. The other thing that I think that I've seen it's different is it is easier for male survivors to come forward in some ways. Mary, I know, has done a lot of research in that field, so she may have some thoughts to add. The other thing that I see that's different from when the rape crisis movement first started is we're now also looking quite a bit at child sexual abuse and what happens with kids and how we can work with kids that are affected by sexual violence.
When you talk about the number of people, or that wasn't the word you used, but the greater acceptance of people coming out to talk about it, is that true? What is the percentage of that? And I always say statistics are whatever side of it you want to believe. But there's certainly more emphasis from whatever area of life that you're from, whether you're representing Sexual Assault Resource Agency. We had an interview not too long ago here on Wake Up Call with people from the Women's Center at UVA that you didn't do anything wrong. There's no embarrassment about coming forth. You're actually making it easier for those others who are concerned about their shame or the feeling of shame that they may have, incorrect feeling of shame, I should put out there. So talk about what has made it okay or better for anyone, and I keep wanting to say women, and we've already said that that's not true. I will make mistakes throughout the hour because I'm a male who hasn't experienced this and is unaware of a woman who has come forth in my life to talk about her victimization. Or again, there's another word that I crossed out repeatedly on my paper and changed it to survivor. So what has made this better and easier? Amanda, can you talk about this?
Sure. I think one of the biggest shifts that I've seen, and I'm not sure if it's taken full effect yet, but I think there's been a greater emphasis placed on, I'm trying to articulate what I want to say. I think there's a bigger emphasis placed on it not being your fault. Like you said, I think the cultural aspects of it haven't changed as much. I think it still is stigmatized by and large. I think that victims, survivors do still feel a shame about it. There's still a cultural, there's still an aspect of it that is placing the blame on the victim. But I think in sexual assault education and prevention, the biggest shift has been taking it away from teaching the victim how to prevent it from happening versus teaching the perpetrator not to perpetrate. I think that that's been a huge shift in that, especially across universities, you see less and less of teaching how not to get raped, how not to get assaulted, and more of what assault is, and how not to cross those lines.
Well, let me jump right into that. Let me find my little note here. Is that there's a lot of effort put forth on teaching, again, I'm going to say women, and I'm going to continue to say it, and please accept that. But there's a lot of effort put forth towards women on teaching them not to put yourself in certain situations. Don't drink too much. Don't walk alone at night. By doing that, are we telling men, and not all men, but again, that small percentage of men who may be those creating these crimes, are we telling them, giving them that little window that says, she brought it on herself, it's okay for me to do it?
I think there are still a lot of people who believe that. And I think what, as Amanda said, is there really has been a significant shift in terms of how we view prevention. And I think a lot of it's still, you know, certainly there's good common sense situations. But I think if we want to look at a university situation, for example, in a fraternity house, if a woman's really drunk, then ideally you want to have a guy having his frat brothers telling him, look, she's too drunk. Don't take her upstairs. Don't do anything. She's not in a place to make consent versus blaming her for having been drunk. There's been a shift that's happening, and I think is happening more, where we're starting to look at things a different way. I think what a lot of survivors feel is often they feel like, I think Amanda touched on this briefly, is they feel like for themselves that they did something wrong, that they somehow made a mistake, were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and should have been able to avoid that. We all have the right to live our lives.
Well, we are talking with members of SARA, Sexual Assault Resource Agency. That's Becky Waybright, the executive director. Amanda Huskin is a multi-year volunteer. Mary McGregor doing her internship at SARA while pursuing her master's of social work at VCU. Mary, how do you talk about this with men and give them both the information on how they can help prevent the crimes and changing this long-term belief that they can help, that they can help?
The way I think about approaching men about sexual assault is that they are equally can be a victim. The statistics are almost 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 men are sexually assaulted, and 1 in 4 girls, women, are sexually assaulted. So I think of it more as like we all have a responsibility to educate ourselves about boundaries, what are the expectations out of, you know, having sex and kind of thinking about healthy relationships, healthy views on gender norms, gender roles, respecting kind of people for who they are, whether they're male or female.
Well, we know that men learn things differently. I don't think I'm making that into a big unknown belief, but men learn differently, and certainly the topic of sex, men, the different genders have different beliefs about that. And when you get into sexual assault, how do you teach men that there is more to it than the fact that it's wrong? Becky?
I think some of it, kind of piggybacking a little bit on what Mary said, I think some of it is really talking more, not just talking about assault, but also talking about consent and what does consent mean, and for men, making sure that they have consent in any terms of sexual activity. Also for men, realizing that if a woman says yes to something, that doesn't mean she's necessarily said yes to everything. And that if she says yes to something, she still has the right at any point in time to say no. I think there are a lot of, when you kind of look at how boys are raised and how boys talk with each other when they start talking about sexual activity, I think some of it is really looking at what is consent and do they have it, And are they sure that they have it?
What happens if both? We always hear that a female being drunk, you can't get consent from a drunk woman. What if the male is drunk as well?
Mary, do you want to, you're making a comment?
Oh, I think then they're both not in the position to make very good decisions.
Well, I would agree with that.
And I think ideally in that situation, it can be harder to know what to say. Sometimes that can be where a third party can intervene. You know, a friend, somebody in there can intervene and try to stop the situation. Because I think if both parties are drunk, neither one of them may be in a position to consent.
11:17 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today from the Sexual Assault Resource Agency here in Charlottesville, Mary McGregor, doing her internship. Amanda Huskin, multi-year volunteer. Becky Waybright, the executive director. We'll get right back. I want to talk about some of the legislation going on. I want to talk about what it's like to be a phone volunteer. And I want to talk about some of the issues involved, some of the, not just the cultural issues, but some of the social work issues that come about for women, for survivors of any gender after an assault.
Support for WNRN today comes from Italian Villa, Charlottesville's old school diner at Emmett and Ivy. Before the game or after church, the Villa serves a full American breakfast all day. You can find burgers and specialty sandwiches for lunch, plus weekday lunch specials and an Italian dinner menu every night. That's Italian Villa, 129 Emmett Street North.
Today's programming is supported by State Farm Insurance. At the office of State Farm agent Larry Whitlock in Charlottesville, Larry is there to walk you through a check of your car insurance, whether it's combining car and house insurance or looking at grades. Larry can help you stretch your paycheck without reducing coverage. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Thank you so much for listening to WNRN. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm Rick Moore, talking with three representatives from the Charlottesville SARA, Sexual Assault Resource Agency, Becky Waybright, Amanda Huskin, Mary McGregor. Amanda, you're a phone volunteer?
Yes.
Tell me about the training, because I would assume that there are volunteers of many roles to be fulfilled, and the phone volunteer is the one that gets the majority of the press, for lack of a better word. Talk to me about the process and becoming a phone volunteer, and any comfort that you have in telling us about sort of a representative conversation, someone calling in and their side of the story, and what you talk to them about and how you do so.
Sure. So the training process, I'm trying to remember, it's been a while, but it was about a 40-hour process that was 2 days a week. We met several hours a night, 2 days a week, for about 6 weeks. And I had been a crisis volunteer before, so I knew some of the training, but this was specifically geared towards sexual assault, obviously, which I had never trained in before. So a lot of it was role-playing, simulations, trying to work through a call and what the appropriate thing to say is. A huge part of it is learning what your role is on the hotline, that you're not there to be a therapist. You're not there to talk on the line with someone for multiple hours. You're not there to be taken advantage of. You know, if a call comes in that makes you feel uncomfortable in any way, it's okay to set that boundary. And then there was also representatives from the community, from the hospital, the ER, the SANE nurse there who specifically handles rape kits when they come into the hospital. She came in and spoke to us. A representative from the police from the police force came in. And a representative from the Women's Center came in and spoke with us as well. So the training was a lot about learning about the resources in the community in order to be able to refer callers to appropriate resources, and in addition to referring them to our other SARA services.
Are you comfortable sort of giving us a standard? And I realize I shouldn't have said that word either. I'm going to do this throughout the hour because that's what this, the point, or one of the points of our conversation is to show that you can't draw a specific image of what happens, who it happens to, not just the process, but the pre and post effects. So can you tell us a little bit about a phone call?
Sure. So, yeah, I think what you said is exactly right. I've gotten calls from people of every gender, every background, every class dynamic, multicultural callers. And I would say a typical call, even though there's certainly no such thing as that, but the call I've handled most often is someone calling in who has not necessarily been recently assaulted or harassed, but is having flashbacks or memories of a previous assault. And usually they've reached out to some resources, but are still just having a difficult time processing it. They've kind of feel like they've tapped out their friends and families as listening ears, and they really are just reaching out to someone to hear their story, because at 2 a.m. or at 9 o'clock at night, they just need somebody to call to talk to that they don't feel like they're bothering. That being said, though, I've gotten plenty of calls from people who have never reached out to anyone before, and they're really just not even ready to necessarily take a legal step or look into therapy options. They're really just making sure that there's somebody out there taking that first step to connect and tell their story to someone for the first time.
Becky, one of the things that I'm doing my homework for this says that survivors of sexual assault crimes are far more likely to remain silent than victims of other crimes.
I think what happens there is that piece of self-blame, of feeling like they did something wrong, and the kind of the embarrassment of having to talk about it. You mentioned earlier the piece about not walking alone late at night, and it's not that assaults don't happen in that situation, but the vast majority of situations with sexual violence are with someone that the survivor knows in some level. So that kind of situation can lead to some blame, some self-blame, some feeling like they did something that was wrong. And I think that's where the silence can come in. And it's really reassuring to hear Amanda talk about that we do have some people that call us and it's the first time they've reached out, because ideally they'll continue to reach out in some way or another and get some of the healing that could come.
Again, Sexual Assault Resource Agency is our topic today on WNRN. Thanks for listening. It's 11:24. Becky Waybright is here, the executive director. Mary McGregor, working on her master's degree and doing her internship with Sarah. Amanda Huskin, a multi-year phone crisis volunteer. So one of the missions of Sarah is to reduce sexual assault 100%. But I would assume that one of the goals that in the meantime or during this is to bring up 100% for survivors to talk about it, admit to it, and make legal claims wherever possible. How do you do that? As we talk about how, Amanda says that she gets phone calls from people, this is their first step. They just want to talk about it. They're not ready to take a legal step. How do you convince survivors, male or female, that it's okay to talk about it and you need to take a legal step to help us reach the other side and make the assaults all go away?
A lot of where we come from is to help empower the survivor. So we're not going to push them to do something they don't want to do. We're just not going to. When somebody is a victim of sexual violence, they have choices taken away from them. So a lot of what we're going to do is come from the angle of how can we help give choices back to you. And we're not going to push somebody to go forward legally. I mean, that's just where we're going to come from.
But while you might not say you must, isn't there a way that you can say we'd like you to, or find some mannerism that leads them along this, even if it's not by pushing with a soft finger.
I can tell Mary's ready to chime in here.
So. I just wanted to reinforce again that sexual assault breaks families. It breaks up communities. It breaks up organizations. So again, like we want them to make the choice, and we really try not to push one way or another. We do offer individual therapy and group support groups to help with that, with the healing process. And, you know, maybe one day they will. But unfortunately, I mean, as much as maybe we would like them to report, I mean, it's really about what they want and what their needs are.
Mary McGregor, working on her Masters of Social Work at VCU and doing her internship with the Charlottesville SARA organization. Tell me a little bit about the social dynamics. And by that, what I'm talking about is poverty and all those types of things that go along with someone who has suffered and is a survivor of sexual assault. Does having that event happen to them take you down a negative slope? Other than just, you know, I think it's obvious that it's personally mental. Again, I'm just cringing at word choices
right.
I use.
No, you're right. You know, so much research has been done trying to figure this out. You know, once sexual assault happens, for one, to an individual, it is like 5 times more likely to happen to them again. So it's oftentimes that it doesn't happen just once to someone.
Is it found that it's from the same person or from another person in that small group, like another family member? Or,
you know, those specifics I don't know, but it's interesting. And again, you think of what are the external factors and the internal factors. So external meaning, are they living in poverty? Do they not have a good social support network to kind of get through their healing process? Are they avoiding it? Mentally, have they picked up, you know, drinking, PTSD, and negative habits, I want to say, or maladaptive coping skills to deal with their triggers, the trauma that they experience. So, and again, we all have said before, it's sexual assault is something that has no boundaries. It's in every social class. It's in all kinds of communities. It's everywhere. So it's not, that has been found, it's not limited to one specific area of our culture.
Goodness gracious. 11:29 here on the Wake Up Calls. We talk about sexual assault, the Charlottesville Sexual Assault Resource Agency, SARA. Our guest today, that was Mary McGregor, doing her internship with SARA. Amanda Huskin here has been a volunteer on the crisis hotline. Becky Waybright is the executive director. I see the phone ringing. I haven't even given out the number. 979-0919 is local. If you are elsewhere, it's 877-WNRN-ROCKS. Let me do this.
WNRN is supported by Price Hyundai on 29 North. From Hyundai, it's the new Sonata Hybrid, 38 miles per gallon highway, and breakthrough lithium polymer technology. Also, the 38 miles per gallon highway Elantra. You can find out more at jimpricehyundai.com.
Hi, I'm Ryan Blosser, coordinator for Project Grows.
And I'm Lisa Millett, assistant coordinator of education and programming for Project Grows.
Project Grows is a nonprofit youth-oriented community farm in Verona, Virginia, funded by the Virginia Foundation for Healthy Youth and Augusta Health. Our mission is to lower the obesity rates of children and youth in Stanton, Waynesboro, and Augusta County by connecting kids to healthy, whole foods through nutrition education and hands-on experience.
This spring, Project Grows is looking for volunteers to come work in the dirt and learn about sustainable market farming while contributing to the mission of Project Grows. For more information, find us online at Facebook or projectgrows.org.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection@WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
All right, talking about sexual assault. I don't know why this topic is so difficult for me. Again, it's never happened to me. I'm not aware of any family members or friends of any gender that have experienced this, despite the fact that the statistics tell us that I should have more than one family member or friend who's been through this. But Mary, you're masters of social work. That's why I asked you about, and I forget what phrase you used, but going down the negative slope with maladaptive methods chosen to deal with it. Why would someone working on their masters of social work come to do their internship at Sexual Assault Resource Agency?
Well, if you want to get a master's in social work, you can slowly become a licensed clinical social worker, which means you can give therapy. And that is my focus, is clinical social work. So at Sarah, I have been, I have clients who I see individually, and I also am a part of our support group. And the reason why I have fallen into and why I chose Sarah, for one, it's a great organization. The people there are great, and I love working in this field, and I think it's crucial to social work. And that is because I've worked in a maternity home with women who were maybe impregnated by a stepfather. I've worked in DC. I worked in a women's shelter where most of the homeless women there were victims of sexual assault. And somehow that experience of not healing from it led them to drinking, to substance abuse. And of course, this doesn't always happen, but I just found in working with women and that was there, that at the seed of all these other problems, all these external factors, not being able to find housing or not, being in poverty or, not being able to be in a healthy relationship with a man, that often was the seed of the problems. The root of the issue was this issue.
That's Mary McGregor doing her internship at Sarah. Becky, talk about something that's in the news, specific to our area. Albemarle County Board of Supervisor member Chris Dumler. Sarah recently put out a statement. He admitted to his, and I forget what his specific misdemeanor sexual battery. And Sarah said, step down.
We did.
Talk about why. I mean, he was accused of a felony. He admitted to a misdemeanor. He's got some people on the board supporting him. I guess the vote was 3-2. Many people say that that's strictly politics. It has nothing to do with the crime, strictly politics. And Sarah comes out and says, you need to step down.
And I need to be clear, we were not looking at it at all from a political aspect. We were looking at it from an aspect of he pled guilty to a sexual crime. It may have been a misdemeanor, but he pled guilty to sexual battery. And from our viewpoint, we wanted to make a statement to say that this was not okay for him to continue to represent people.
The feedback that you've gotten?
It's been mixed. I'll be very honest with that. I would say overall it's been favorable of us coming forward with a statement. I think some people who weren't in favor of us coming forward, I think some people felt like we were stepping into making a political statement, but our statement was from his aspect of him having pled guilty to a sexual crime.
We'll take some phone calls if you want to call in with your viewpoint, not just on Mr. Dumler and Sarah's statement on his crime, but 979-0919 877 WNRN Rocks here, talking about sexual assault with members from Charlottesville's Sexual Assault Resource Agency here at Sarah in our area. Let's talk about children, because certainly that's an issue that has been in the news. For every time you turn around, there's something that involves sexual assault of a child. But I want to talk about how, because they're not going to call the crisis hotline, I would assume, correct?
Yeah,
Amanda, have you talked to anyone who's younger than maybe a teen?
No, our policy is that if anyone below the age of 18 calls, then I would then call the staff volunteer who works with children in the office and connect them. So we don't speak to anyone younger than 18 on the line. I will say, though, we've gotten calls from family members concerned about children they either thought were being molested or assaulted, and or you know, it had come out and they were processing it as a family member, as a bystander, or calls from people who were assaulted as children and who are now processing as adults. I'd say those are fairly common.
So Becky, is there we know from the crisis hotline that there's a different method of working through this process with children. Talk a little bit about that. I want to know about the cultural issues that go along with that. Is it different from a young woman who may have been drunk when it happened versus a child, and the process of Sarah in working with it?
I think often we find out about it with kids when either a parent will call us, or some family member has found out, or a counselor may have referred a child to us. I think the biggest piece that can be different with children is the broader impact on the family, because it is more than likely going to be someone that the child knows. So if it's another family member, if it's a caretaker, then there's a much broader, the ripple effects that kind of go out can be quite extensive. It can tear apart families. It really can be very challenging in terms of the impact that it can make. I will say that I think that is definitely one area of sexual violence that has become more open and more talked about than it was 10, 20 years ago.
And why is that?
I think in the past it's often just been sort of kept in the family, and people have just either not believed the child. I think that's been very common. I think because there is more awareness of the issue and we talk about it more, people are more likely to believe a child. Sometimes I think in the past, I heard somebody talk about this the other day, if you know, a kid comes forward and brings this out, and all of a sudden there's all this turmoil, and so then all of a sudden you have this six-year-old who wants to say, oh no, it didn't really happen, because all these bad things have started to happen once the child came forward. So then the child says, no, it didn't really happen. And then sometimes people have wanted to say, okay, well, then the kid just made this up. When in reality, if a child brings something like that forward, you still have to kind of look at what's going on. And even though it may make it really scary for the child, that's where you have to give some safety for the kid so that the child can continue to talk about the situation.
Is there a difference in family age levels? And by in terms of discussing it and accepting it? And I bring that up talking about the grandparent age versus the parent versus the children, because when the issue happened at Penn State, someone that I know was talking about Coach Joe Paterno, who received a lot of negativity because it happened on his watch and he must have known about it, and how could he let this happen? And someone I know said, you know, Mr. Paterno probably thought about it from the grandparents' age, which is, let's keep it in the family. That's why we don't tell others. And then it continued to happen because he turned the other way. Now, while we can say that that's not acceptable, it doesn't matter, it needs to be dealt with, do you find that that is more often a behavior of people who lived in a time, you know, the grandparents, the older age, who lived in that time when we didn't talk about it. It was kept in the family. You didn't make it. It wasn't a cultural topic, and you certainly didn't let your neighbors know.
I think most of us, if we look at all of our families, regardless of what issues happened, people want to keep it in the family. They don't necessarily want to air their dirty laundry, for lack of a better description. When you talk about the Penn State case, you know, some of these young men, when they were boys, did tell people, and they weren't believed. So if you tell somebody that you think, you know, kids are raised, a lot of kids start to hear these things. If something bad happens, if you're lost, go to a police officer, go to a teacher. And if a young person goes to that person and they aren't believed, then they're not going to go forward again.
And kind of one statement I heard is that it's easier to have a liar in the family than to actually have a perpetrator or an offender in the family. So oftentimes, you know, the child then is a liar. It's easier to accept that way.
11:42 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today from Charlottesville's SARA, Sexual Assault Resource Agency, Becky Waybright, Amanda Huskin, Mary McGregor. Amanda and Mary, I direct this to you first. The University of Virginia is not seen, at least from the not-so-distant past, as being very good at helping women who come forward claiming sexual assault. I want to talk about this from your perspective. Becky, I hope I'm not giving away our age, but Amanda and Mary, closer to the age of a current university student. Does this conversation go on amongst your friends and social friends talking about, gosh, what would happen if I went there? Does this make any part of your decision in terms of where to go to school or what to do if around university school age?
I did go to UVA, and I don't think it was something that I thought about when making my decision for schools by any means. And it was luckily not something that I had to deal with while in school. But while training for SARA, it really stuck with me when we went over the university's process of how they encouraged victims who came forward to deal with the matter. And I think, you know, referencing what you said about keeping it in the family, I think UVA by and large has had that mindset. And I hope that's something that's changing. But before, victims who came forward were definitely encouraged to seek mediation, to seek reconciliation with the person who assaulted them. They were encouraged to sit down in the same room with them, with a third party, and talk it out rather than seek any legal or even academic recourse.
Mary?
Yeah, you know, this is difficult for me to think about because it's been a while since I was an undergrad and having friends who were assaulted. I did go through the process with one friend to a mediation like that. Mm-hmm. But more what I think about, I don't know if it would influence where I went because I feel like generally, if this happens to you, you don't tell anyone and you don't go anywhere. At the very least, go to the ER. I don't think anyone does that. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. I have been an ER in the ER with at UVA.
Tell the stupid people like myself why that's so important to you. Going to the ER.
Oh, yeah. If you're assaulted, you want to go to the emergency room because something might have happened. You want to make sure you don't have any STIs and get medication that you need and have a nurse practitioner make sure that everything kind of there isn't anything bad that happened down there, and just make sure that everything is good. And also, they do a perk exam where they will actually collect evidence, as much evidence as they can from your clothes, from your body, that could be used for a case against the person who assaulted you.
So, Becky, my understanding is that UVA has, in some ways, changed their procedures because of all the media attention that came forth in the last decade. Have they reached an acceptable methodology as far as Sarah is concerned?
I don't have a whole lot of history of that because I haven't been at Sarah long enough. But what I would say is that we have good communication with the University of Virginia, and I think this is an issue that is being looked at. I think we can look at UVA because UVA is in our backyard, but I think when you look at any college campus, there's always the risk of sexual assault. I think you can also look at any college that has a strong fraternity system and kind of look at that and whether that might be a potential factor that's in there. And I'm certainly not bashing frats. They're a large part of a lot of university life. But I think there is a lot of work going on at UVA. There are a lot of people that are very much interested in looking at the issue of gender violence and how it can be reduced.
11:48 here on the Wake Up Call with our guest from Sarah. It's Amanda Huskin, Becky Waybright, and Mary McGregor. We'll be right back.
Michelle Knuckles, mortgage banker with Westar Mortgage, joins our members in support of independent music radio WNRN. Westar can help with a purchase or refinance from first-time buyers to jumbo loans. You can reach Michelle at michelleknuckles.com. Two L's in Michelle, NUCKOLS.com. Westar Mortgage is an equal opportunity housing company. NMLS number
198053. And WNRN says thanks to our sustaining members like Jennifer from Grinnellan, who's a member of the CD of the Month Club. It's easy to become a member. And to join the CD of the Month clubs, just go to WNRN.org and click on Donate. And please remember that at the end of March will be the Spring Fun Drive for WNRN. I want to talk for a minute about the Violence Against Women Act. It's a federal issue that has, I guess it didn't get passed, or the original verbiage that was used in the 1990s was changed and made it less forceful, if I'm correct, less funding that goes with it. And then now the goal is to pass it with stronger words. Can you talk about that, Becky?
I can talk about it a little bit. I have to tell you, I'm not as completely up on it as maybe you are even. The Violence Against Women Act was originally passed in 1994, and then this past fiscal year, at the end of December, if everybody remembers all the fiscal cliff stuff and everything along with that, the Violence Against Women Act was left out when they finally did do all the different passages that they needed to do by the end of the year so that we didn't all fall off the fiscal cliff. What the Violence Against Women Act is still in effect currently until October of 2013, and it's now being reintroduced. I think some of the controversial issues that were part of it that were of concern were related to extending some of the rights to with the Violence Against Women Act to Native Americans and to the lesbian, gay, and bisexual transgender population.
My understanding is that currently, I guess Tuesday, I believe, passed by the Senate and currently waiting for the U.S. House of Representatives to determine what to do next.
That's correct.
If you go online, if the conversation today interests you and gets you caught up in everything that's happening in the sexual assault resource conversation, go online, certainly easily find it. VAWA, Violence Against Women Act. I'm sure that will lead you somewhere, somehow, to contact your federal House of Representatives member and do more. Let me talk a minute. This is this sort of similar line always comes up about, not, we said the word liar several times in a few minutes ago. And even though the person may not be a liar, which is a strong word, one of the goals, one of the missions for Sarah and for many groups is to, you know, you don't want to overlook any victim. Every victim needs assistance, needs help of some manner. But do you take on the mission that you don't want even one person incorrectly accused or jailed? And how do you make those two meet? Because my homework says that apparently 2% that's been done by the FBI and I think other legal groups, that 2% of, I keep wanting to say men, but 2% of folks have been incorrectly accused. How do you make those two missions meet? Mary?
Well, that's a very small percentage.
But if you're that one.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say that that statistic is pretty consistent across all crimes. 2% is about the average across all crimes of false reporting. So I don't think that in sexual assault it needs to be a primary goal any more than it is with the police department investigating robberies or anything like that.
The other thing I would add is that our job at Sarah, and this is where we come from, but our job as advocates, is to believe the survivor who's there with us.
I guess that's what our legal situation is for, is to determine the 2%. 11:53 on the wake up call. Our guest Becky Waybright, the executive director of Charlottesville's Sarah, Amanda Huskin, a multi-year volunteer on the critical phone line, and Mary McGregor doing her internship at Sarah. Did any of you hear about the movie that's being brought forth up for an Oscar? What's it called? The Invisible War. Mary, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, it's a great documentary.
You've seen it.
Yes, I have. It's about sexual assault in the military of men and women. And women in particular are more likely to be sexually assaulted in the military than to die in combat.
Good grief. Really?
Yes.
One of the things that I found most interesting, again, I haven't seen the documentary, I've just heard the discussion about it, is that one of the main issues that they bring up in this documentary is that the judges are often folks, or more likely to be folks, that are in the chain of command. They oversee either the victim, the survivor, or the person who committed the assault, because that's how the military works. And that there is effort being put forth to change that and let the judge be someone who is not in that, correct, a civilian, mm-hmm. someone who doesn't know the individuals involved.
Mm-hmm.
Are you, either anyone in the group, familiar with situations and how you take away people who are somehow overseeing or involved in determining right or wrong from people who are involved? What happens if a police officer is involved and knows the people on either side of this discussion or some similar case?
They're taken out of the case usually, even a judge, I believe. If they know who may be standing trial, they ask for another judge to sit in. I believe it's always the goal to have someone who is not affiliated.
So The Invisible War, again, I recommend that as a documentary for people to see. It is up for an Oscar.
Yes.
So it should be out there somewhere playing. 11:55 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about sexual assault with our guests today. One of the interesting things I saw on your website, anybody remember the official name for the website? I can't remember. It's like sexualassaults.org or sexualassaultseville.org.
SarahSeville.org.
And by the way, your Facebook page needs to be updated. I didn't see anything like after December of last year.
Okay, thanks.
Who's in charge of that?
None of us in this room, but I'll work on that next week.
I talk about the bilingual. I mentioned that very early in the show about how you now had someone who was bilingual in terms of helping survivors.
We have two people on staff that are bilingual with Spanish. Both our child advocate and then our therapist are both bilingual with Spanish. And one of the things that I've seen, and again, I'm new at the agency, but one of the things that I've seen is that our statistics in terms of the number of people with Hispanic background that we serve has increased because of that. I think because it gives a little more comfort for people with that community to come forward and talk with us.
Do you think that the chicken and the egg thing is the bilingual because that was needed, because that culture was becoming more comfortable in talking about this, or are you getting more calls and more people coming forward because you finally had someone who could understand what they were trying to talk about?
I think our goal was just because we were seeing that the community was changing in terms of its demographic makeup, and we wanted to be able to respond to that with our services.
Amanda, have you, as someone working in the critical hotline, crisis hotline, I guess, proper term, have you heard more different cultures on the other side? I mean, it's just an article recently, whether it was in the paper or on the news, about the International Resource Agency. Is that
International Rescue Committee.
International mm-hmm. Rescue. Do you hear different ethnic sounds on the other end of the phone?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a resource where we can actually dial for an outside number to get a translation if the person is unable to speak English. I've never had a call where I've needed to use that, but I've certainly heard different accents, different backgrounds, people. I've never gotten international calls, but I've had people in from other countries that have moved to the United States that are using our services. And I will say, if you Google sexual assault resources, we're one of the first agencies that come up. So even though our mission is to primarily serve the Charlottesville area, we get calls from all across the country.
And Mary, as you do your internship but go to class at VCU on a regular basis, has this become a greater conversation? In terms of, it's not just, you know, American men and women, but now as our culture changes here in the United States, that we need to talk about it from slightly different viewpoints or other ethnic backgrounds?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've always kind of had an international awareness of these issues. On some level, it's just interests me. But what I love about in America is that, you know, we are a democratic society, and we try to get the voice of all the people living in this, in our country, make their voices visible and heard in some way. And we, you know, definitely try to become culturally aware of all these different cultures living in our community so that we can respond appropriately, knowing what general myths are within different cultural communities and how they typically handle sexual assault, the family structure, and how decisions are usually made in those different cultures. We try to definitely, that was a part of the training, I recall, the volunteer training, is becoming aware of those things.
All right, time to finish up here at noon here on the Wake Up Call. Becky, last word, any fund drives or fundraising coming up for Sarah that you want to share with the crowd?
We do have our annual Three for All, which is a three-legged race. It'll be on April 13th. That's Thomas Jefferson's birthday, so it's a Saturday, and it'll be on the downtown mall at 10 in the morning. We'd love to have people sign up to be in that.
Okay. All right. Thanks to the three of you for coming on today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Becky Wabright, Executive Director, Amanda Huskin of Crisis Hotline Volunteer, Mary McGregor doing her internship at Sexual Assault Resource Agency. All right, folks. Hope to hear you next week. Thank you.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by The Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Angie Cruz. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.